From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, we check in on Governor Brownback's plan to eliminate income tax in Kansas.
I have a hard time looking at the school children in my neighborhood and saying, I'm going to do an experiment on you, and if we lose, your schools are going down the tubes.
We try to understand what's behind some recent child abuse cases in Kansas City.
I think it's easy to say this tragedy could have been avoided, but we don't know what the parents had been through, and we don't know what the child had been through.
Plus, Ash Wednesday for People on the Go.
As Lent begins, we remember the truth of our existence, which is from dust we were created to dust we will return.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
If the president is moving towards a larger role for government, a number of states are racing the opposite direction, and Kansas is arguably moving the fastest. Governor Sam Brownback has put the state on what he calls a glide path to zero income tax. KCUR's Frank Morris is reporting on that glide path. Is that really a good analogy, Frank?
Well, Sylvia, it's more like sort of a dark, rocky road with no map to zero. And the governor, really, he uses glide path, but he also acknowledges that this is a very difficult thing. Even the people at the American Legislative Exchange Council, which tracks this kind of thing very closely, say, and they're big proponents of zero income tax. They say that is a great thing for a state to have. How you get there is anybody's guess because it's never happened. Kansas is the only state that has had an income tax for these small businesses and then dropped it to zero. That's never happened before.
And we're going to hear your reporting on this in a minute. But first, let me ask you, we're not talking about individual income taxes like what you pay if you earn a salary, right?
That's right. This is for small businesses that are organized as subchapter S or LLCs or sole proprietor businesses. And there are tax advantages and disadvantages to running it this way. But basically what it means is that the owner of the business, the revenue is treated as income for the owner of the business and that you pay income tax based on that, based on your own personal income tax rate rather than a business tax. And this can be, you know, law firms or accounting firms, even factories can be set up this way.
And are there a lot of these businesses in Kansas?
Well, you know, this is one of the funny things about this law. They think there are 191,000 of them, but they're not really sure. And they're not really sure exactly who they are, surprisingly. But yeah, somewhere approaching 200,000 of these businesses with more showing up these days.
Well, let's hear Frank Morris's report now.
On the face of it, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback seems to enjoy a remarkably strong political position. He's a conservative Republican flanked by GOP supermajorities in both legislative chambers. Last election, powerful allies helped purge moderate Republicans from the state Senate. Governor Brownback.
I think the road is open. I think we do provide an alternative model. I think we do provide a red state model.
Last year, Kansas eliminated income tax for about 190,000 small businesses and cut the rate substantially for high-income individuals.
We're going from the highest tax state in the region to the lowest tax state in the region.
Well, Governor Brownback has made very bold moves towards making Kansas a more competitive place to do business and to create jobs.
Jonathan Williams is in charge of fiscal policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council. The group has ties to the Koch brothers and writes so-called model legislation adopted by conservatives around the country. And Williams says no other state has eliminated income tax just for business. And that move is causing a stir in Kansas City right along the state line.
Hey, Frank.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. New digs here, huh?
Yeah, well, they're going to remodel the hallway and everything. Movers come in multiple directions. We're still actually finishing the build out.
Steve Brown is a partner at Mira Welsh Brown, an accounting firm that is this week making a move from Missouri into Kansas. Barely.
Well, we moved from just a mile or 2 miles on the east side of state line to literally, as you can observe looking out the window, we're a few hundred yards on the west side of state line now.
Brad says that none of the firm's 22 employees need to move. Many, in fact, have a little shorter commute. By trading one office building for another, though, and shedding most state taxes, they're boosting the firm's income by upwards of 6%. It's a no-brainer. The harder calculation is whether the firm's gain and Missouri's loss is actually a win for Kansas.
That benefits no one in the end. And it hurts the people because the tax money is gone.
Barbara Beaulieu, a Republican Kansas state representative, pets her cat as she reclines at home in Tony Mission Hills, just north of where the accounting firm is moving. Beaulieu says she's pro-business, but that she can't swallow the size of last year's tax cuts. They'll cost the state more than $850 million annually, with the bulk of it going not to businesses, but to higher-income individuals.
The governor's been very clear. It's an experiment. And it is. We were the only state in the country that did this. So it's either a huge win or a horrible loss.
Beaulieu points out that Kansas relies heavily on income taxes. They account, even now, for about 36% of the state budget. What's more, she notes several other states, including ones that border Kansas, are talking about cutting or eliminating that very same tax. She fears a race to the bottom that generates too few new jobs and too little new money for Kansas to avoid painful consequences.
I have a hard time looking at the school children in my neighborhood and saying, I'm going to do an experiment on you, and if we lose, your schools are going down the tubes.
Governor Brownback promises he's not going to let that happen. He's proposed paying for some of last year's income tax cuts by extending a sales tax that's set to expire and ending some tax deductions. He doesn't like to say so, but
It is a tax increase, absolutely.
Don Hill, another Republican, represents Emporia at the State House.
We have a hole, and we've got to pay for it, or we've got to cut the budget. In reality, we very well may end up in a place where we do a little bit of both.
The governor is proposing additional cuts this year, too, slicing the lower income tax bracket. But that doesn't take effect for years, so the upshot is a tax hike of up to $455 million next year. Democrats call it Robin Hood in reverse, since sales tax tends to hit poor people disproportionately hard. Anthony Hensley is the Senate Minority Leader.
Instead of taking from the rich to give to the poor, governor's tax plan basically takes from the poor and gives to the rich.
The governor's plan is not going over real well with conservative Republicans either. Representative Scott Schwab says backing the governor's proposal would make liars out of them all.
So you're asking me to raise taxes today for a tax cut in 5 years. A lot of folks who campaigned this summer, that was not what they campaigned on. They campaigned on cutting taxes today.
But more tax cuts today on top of the big ones from last year would likely crater the state budget, which would also be unpopular. It's messy. Even Jonathan Williams at the American Legislative Exchange Council has no roadmap for where Kansas is heading.
Well, yeah, I mean, we don't have any model legislation to say, you know, here is how you kill an income tax.
Transitions are the hardest piece of it.
Governor Brownback again.
If you ask people, do you want to do away with the income tax, a good portion would say yes. Okay, now how do you do that?
How, indeed. It's a question vexing Kansas as it struggles to develop a new red state model. Frank Morris, KCUR News.
And Frank is here in the studio with us to share a little bit more about Governor Brownback's plan to eliminate income taxes. What if he doesn't get his tax increases this year? They seem to be pretty unpopular.
They are indeed unpopular. The governor is proposing three major areas to increase taxes, extending a sales tax that would otherwise expire, and then eliminating more the Kansas state income tax deduction for mortgages and on property tax. You can send the state and tell the state how much you paid in property tax and get something back on your income taxes. This is like, you know, $200-$300 per Kansan on average for those two. They're very popular. The real estate agents love these tax deductions. Democrats hate extending the sales tax. There are a lot of problems, a lot of things in the way of the governor getting everything he's asking for. And what he's asking for amounts to a 400, if he gets everything he has asked for, a $455 million tax increase for next year. That's to help offset these huge income tax cuts from last year. If the governor does not get those, there is a little bit of play here because Kansas had a very healthy ending balance, sort of a carryover. Kansas has some money in the bank now, enough to basically cover spending as it is now and not have these tax increases. But you get into very, very difficult decisions in future years unless you add some tax revenue on the balance sheet. And again, this tax cut thing that passed last year, the income tax, eliminating income taxes on the small businesses and dramatically reducing them, especially for the higher wage people, that was only part of the governor's proposal last year. The governor had that balanced with some spending cuts, but also tax increases on other things like the sales tax. So the governor's just trying to get what he asked for last year to balance out the income tax cuts.
And a lot of the newly elected legislators are seen to be Governor Brownback's allies. Does he have a green light to create this red state model in Kansas?
Well, it's interesting, Sylvia. There was a lot of attention last year in the Senate when we looked at the primaries, the Republican primaries for Senate. The Kansas Chamber of Commerce, backed by Koch Industries, came out very stridently against moderate Republicans in the Senate who had been holding up the governor's agenda and beat almost every single one. So now the Senate is very, very friendly to just about anything that the governor proposes. However, because of redistricting last year, the court-ordered redistricting that kind of took a lot of people by surprise, where the court drew districts that have no gerrymandering whatsoever, that in some cases forced incumbents to run against each other. The House is now a completely different body. Last year, the House was kind of the governor's chamber of the legislature, and the Senate was problematic for the governor. This year, it's just flipped over, and it's exactly the opposite. So the House, the people in the House, there are a lot of new representatives who don't want to just be an echo. They want to be a voice. So they're going to take some convincing on these proposals from the governor.
And what's going to be the upshot for all these changes in taxes for the Kansas City area?
That is really a hard thing to say because, you know, you have, for instance, businesses moving, and a lot of businesses, I'm told, are looking at this move. You know, you move across the state line, you get rid of your income tax in Missouri, and there's some other tax advantages. And so you may move across the state line. That is looks like probably Kansas City, Missouri's tax revenue is going to drop. The state of Missouri is probably going to drop. What that means for Kansas, though, again, is a sort of a little bit harder to figure. And so, you know, if you have a bunch of businesses coming in, but then as some critics of the governor's proposals are worried about, if you have a much greater budget pressure on the schools, there's already quite a bit in Kansas. If the schools start to deteriorate, some of the best schools, public schools in the country are on the Kansas side of the Kansas City metropolitan area. If they start to deteriorate, then the whole dynamic shifts again. And so, you know, these advantages, the incentives that are being put out there, they have multiple impacts. What they do is subject to human whims, and it's going to take some time to sort it out.
Frank Morris is KCUR's news director. Thanks for stopping by, KC Currents.
Thanks, Sylvia.
Coming up, a look at the treatment of victims and perpetrators of child abuse. You're listening to KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Child advocates are demanding answers after several recent cases of extreme child abuse have come to light in the Kansas City area. Even before these cases hit the media, a new Missouri House and Senate committee had formed to improve the child welfare system in the state. This is the most recent of many attempts to fix a system that some say is overburdened and underfunded. But beyond the welfare system, it's hard to understand How could parents lock a child in a closet or handcuff a teenager in a basement? Joe Beck is the vice president of Midwest Foster Care and Adoption. He came by the studio to talk to us about these recent cases and tell us about the help that's available to struggling parents. Joe, welcome to Casey Currents.
Thank you.
There have been two high-visibility cases in the news recently, the Northland teen that was handcuffed in the basement and then the 10-year-old girl who was locked in the closet. And both of these cases raise questions about mental health and the child abuse systems. Now, the first case involved a teen who obviously, from what I've read, was struggling with some mental health issues. And I guess the family was saying they didn't have access to medications or they couldn't afford them and treatment. What does this tell us about adequate mental health care for children and youth?
I think it's difficult sometimes to access the services that families need. The system is sometimes complicated. It's difficult to know exactly what kind of services you need. And there's a stigma and judgment that's placed on parents who have children with mental health conditions. So I think those combination of factors make it difficult for the typical family to access services.
Do you think that there's enough information available to parents about resources available to help with special needs youth? Because I do know there are programs that pay for medication, but do you think that information is readily available?
I think it's a difficult challenge for people to navigate the system. Like I said before, the system can be very complex, and knowing how to get what you need is sometimes very difficult. Frequently, parents face a lot of roadblocks to accessing services. Many of the services that are available are income-based, so if the family is at or slightly above the poverty level, they have more difficulty accessing those services. So I think that there are resources available, but to access those services requires quite a bit of skill, and a lot of times families have the stigma to overcome to reach out and ask for help, because a lot of times they're judged. They're judged for not being able to manage their own kids and to parent kids through difficult situations.
Well, obviously, this seemed to be a situation where parents were, frankly, overwhelmed by this teenager. I guess he had become out of control. There were domestic violence calls to the house. How do we help parents who get overwhelmed and don't know what to do or may not even have the understanding they need to respond appropriately?
I think it's important to approach every situation and try to avoid judgment at all costs. It's hard for parents to reach out and ask for help and then be turned away or told that those services aren't available. It gets frustrating and irritating. A lot of times families are already struggling with the balance in their life of maintaining their employment, maintaining their children in school, dealing with law enforcement, dealing with community services. It gets overwhelming, and a little bit at a time, poor decisions or bad judgment gets normalized for these parents, and they feel like they don't have any other choices. It's easy to stand on the outside and look in and say, there's lots out there to help. But from a parent perspective, trying to figure out how do I get that help when I need it can be very challenging and overwhelming.
Well, when you say avoid judgment, I can just hear some listeners saying, but come on now, they handcuffed him to a pole. I mean, when do we just say that something's really wrong with a parent that does something like this?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the parents made very poor decisions in that situation. But we don't know all the details. We don't know that what was done before. We don't know what the parents had tried before. We don't know what roadblocks or barriers they attempted to overcome and were unsuccessful. So I think it's easy to say this tragedy could have been avoided, but we don't know what the parents had been through. Up to that point, and we don't know what the child had been through and what challenges he had faced in accessing services. Most mental health services for a child of 17 years of age are voluntary, and if he didn't feel like he had a problem or needed help, that might disqualify him from getting the help that he needed.
So they couldn't force him to go to get treatment would be an issue, right?
It's very difficult to force somebody to get assistance when they're not asking for it or wanting the help.
Now, you know, back to the domestic violence calls, the police were called to the home on several occasions. In our current system, how does this not become a warning sign? Because I hear this from parents. I hear parents say, you know, I have a 6'1", 15-year-old who I can't
restrain, or I can't tell him what to do. He leaves when he wants to. And when I call the police, they just tell me, oh, well, there's nothing we can do.
I think that's a challenge that many parents face as youth with mental health problems get older and they don't quite have the insight to know that they need help. I think it's difficult to access those services. Law enforcement is doing a much better job of training their law enforcement officers on mental health needs. However, it's still a unique situation that many of the officers on the street don't understand how to manage it. Frequently, mental health symptoms look like a child who's just being defiant or obstinate. And I think it's a challenge to find the balance between where's the risk and safety factors, and should this parent be able to manage this?
Well, you know, some states have status offender laws so that, you know, when there's an early warning sign like this, they can actually take youth into custody and then wrap around some services to help them get back on track. But Missouri doesn't have that kind of law.
That's correct. And it's a challenge for the juvenile justice system because a lot of times the juvenile justice system is trying to provide support to parents and youth. However, there has to be a crime committed of some kind. And the systems just haven't quite caught up with the need. Again, those systems are working hard to improve the services they offer, but it's a difficult situation.
Now, in this instance also, you had the family cutting off food, and you hear this in a lot of child abuse cases where parents will cut off food and that sort of thing. How do we understand that? Why is that a role in so many abuse cases?
A lot of times in abuse cases, it's about power and control. And for parents who are out of equilibrium, their lives are out of balance, they're struggling to find control. And sometimes in order to improve the situation, they feel like, well, if I can control this thing that they need, then in some way I'll be able to get them to comply with what I'm asking them to do. Sometimes there are real risk factors. Sometimes there are perceived risk factors. But in any case, abuse is about power and control. And when parents feel like they're losing control, they'll go to drastic measures to try to find a way to control a child's behavior to get them to comply with their requests.
Now, it sounds like a teen like this that was having mental health problems and maybe struggled with being out of control sometimes would be a candidate for one of our residential treatment programs. But I know Missouri and Kansas have really been trying to reduce the number of residential beds available for troubled youth. How is that a factor in cases like this?
I think frequently people feel like if there was just somewhere that this child could go, they could solve the problem. The reality is residential treatment is extraordinarily expensive and is not necessarily the most effective way in managing behaviors. People deserve to live in the least restrictive environment. So in situations like that, you create a perfect storm where the systemic knowledge that residential treatment isn't the most effective treatment, combined with the reality that there are some very difficult children to manage, it creates kind of a dip in resources that are available, and they create barriers to accessing those resources at times. I don't think it's anybody's intention to make the system worse. However, in an effort to reduce cost and improve quality of care, they've eliminated some valuable resources of residential care in both Kansas and Missouri.
Now, in this case, this is a teenager who will soon turn 18 and be transitioning into so-called adulthood. But what resources are available to help someone like him after the experience he's had and that will launch him successfully into adulthood?
There are some creative programs out there that are being offered by the local community mental health centers to help youth with mental health issues transition into the adult system. Statistics have kind of showed us that youth who have mental health problems frequently get lost in the system because many of the services that have been traditionally offered are for adults who have long-term persistent mental illnesses. These kids transitioning in don't look like those other service recipients, and the services haven't been geared. There's a new initiative called the TIP program that was instituted by Truman Behavioral Health. They're doing a lot of work on figuring out how to transition youth from children's mental health services into adult mental health services in a seamless way that empowers those youth to access services and be healthy, productive members of the community.
Clinical social worker Joe Beck is vice president for Midwest Foster Care and Adoption. Next week, we'll hear more from Beck, including a closer look at another recent child abuse case and what can be done to prevent it.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Sales of specialty cheeses sold in U.S. grocery stores grew 7% last year, in large part because of increasing demand for exotic artisanal cheeses. That includes raw cheeses made from unpasteurized milk. Raw milk cheese has gathered a fervent following for its taste, nutritional benefits, and freshness. But as Abby Fentress Swanson reports for Harvest Public Media, recent safety concerns threaten the market.
I've spent a lot of time in front of cheese coolers in my life. That's because I love cheese, whether it's Stilton, Gruyere, or Drunken Goat. But raw milk cheese? That's new to me. So I asked Noah Earle, the grocery manager at Clover's Natural Market in Columbia, Missouri, to recommend a raw milk cheese for me to try.
I thought I'd choose a couple cheddars, if you're game.
Cool. We head to the back of the store and slice up a shiny yellow raw milk cheddar.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Hmm. I wasn't really expecting that.
No.
It's very smooth. It's smoother in consistency than the one we just tried.
Mm-hmm.
We were just eating that raw cheese straight, but Clover's customer Senyata Markey likes her raw cheese on top of apples. In fact, she doesn't eat cheese unless it's raw because her blood's type A.
Type A's, just because of our biology, do not digest dairy well or meat, and we're unable to assimilate the nutrients from those products. Now, mainly when it comes to dairy, I feel like it was part of the pasteurization process that makes it unavailable to me. And so the raw cheese, I could eat.
Consumers like Markey believe that raw cheese is more nutritious because pasteurization hasn't killed living beneficial organisms in the milk. But not pasteurizing can also allow harmful bacteria to live. And contamination problems have been a challenge for Missouri cheesemakers lately. Morningland Dairy in Mountain View, Missouri, just went out of business after the state milk board seized 36,000 pounds of its raw cheese because some of it was found to be contaminated with listeria and staph. Also in the northwestern part of the state, three people got sick after eating a raw cheese called Flory's Favorite. A batch of it tested positive for E. coli. Nebraska cheesemaker Krista Dittman says these problems can be devastating for the raw milk industry.
I think it creates a lot of fear in the industry, and it creates a lot of dissonance between producers and regulators.
Dittman's talking about the feeling from small producers that inspectors from state agriculture departments and the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates the raw milk cheese industry, will never find their operations to be clean enough or safe enough to meet their standards. Morningland Dairy's lawyer Pete Kennedy points out another fear.
Well, I think it creates a chilling effect on other people getting into the business. You know, you're going to spend all that money on equipment and a plant if something like this can happen.
But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say raw milk cheese poses a very real threat, sickening hundreds of people over the past decade. A few years ago, the FDA began a comprehensive risk assessment of raw milk cheese, which can be sold legally nationwide as long as it has been aged 60 days. The FDA is expected to release its findings by the end of September, and some producers worry the agency will extend the amount of time required to age raw cheese, or, worse, ban the sale of raw cheese across state lines. But food safety expert Richard Raymond wouldn't mind a raw milk cheese ban.
The pasteurization of milk, which became more or less the standard in the 1940s, dramatically dropped the incidence of foodborne illnesses, particularly in children, because it's a very simple step to guarantee the safety of the milk.
Back at Clover's, a regular named Kathy Lane stands in one of my favorite spots at the cheese cooler and gazes at the dozens of delectable cheeses available for sale. She and her 11-year-old daughter don't eat products made from pasteurized cow's milk due to antibiotics that might be found in them. But she's still debating whether or not to try raw milk cheese.
Would you ever consider raw milk or raw milk cheese?
Good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I would try it, but I'm not sure.
For the raw milk cheese industry, that uncertainty is a familiar feeling. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
These days, you can get a lot at a drive-thru without leaving the comfort of your car. Coffee, dry cleaning, a cheeseburger. And this past Wednesday morning, imposing of ashes. Two churches in Prairie Village offered single-serve Ash Wednesday services to commuters in their cars. Alex Smith stopped by one to watch the season of Lent, kicked off at the speed of rush hour.
At just before 7:30 on a chilly morning, Pastor Aaron Roberts stepped out of the Colonial Church in Prairie Village and marched out to the curb where cars roared past. Wearing a stole and a black robe, he planted a sign in the grass reading Ash Wednesday Drive-Thru. Before long, Roberts saw a slow but steady trickle of takers. As each car pulled up, it took Roberts just about 15 seconds to deliver a blessing and draw a cross in ashes with his thumb on the commuter's forehead.
As Lent begins, we remember the truth of our existence, which is from dust we were created to dust we will return. Go with God. Blessings.
About half who drove through were members of the church, and about half were just passing by. After receiving the imposition, a few explained what brought them.
My name is Raina Ochoa, because I'm so busy today and I won't be able to go to Mass today because my kids have basketball, and so this was a great opportunity. I just saw it. I didn't even know about it.
I'm Marilyn Upman, and when I got up this morning, I thought, do I want to go over there? And then I thought, yes, I need to go.
Well, we were imposing ashes, and this is the first time for this church to do this. And if Aaron is willing to stand out here in the cold, I'm willing to come and get them.
Pastor Aaron Roberts says the church started the drive-thru service this year to accommodate the needs of congregants who couldn't make the evening Ash Wednesday service. The Colonial Church is part of the United Church of Christ, one of many Christian denominations that practices imposing of ashes. Roberts explains the significance of the tradition.
I mean, there's lots of stories about where the tradition of Ash Wednesday came from. One of them is that there was a priest in France back in this, I think it's the 6th century, who every year there was a day where they would bring out prisoners in the community and humiliate them by covering them with ashes. And then one year, as a protest of that practice and the treatment of those prisoners, the priest covered himself in ashes, and somehow that got tied together with Ash Wednesday. It means a lot of different things to people, but usually it's a sign of repentance and things that we would like to change about ourselves. It's also that when you put the ashes on someone, the words are spoken, and the truth of our nature is, from dust we were created and to dust we will return. Which, no matter who you are, it's kind of a grounding statement of what it means to be human.
Robert says wearing a cross of ashes can draw attention, but that's part of the ritual.
People look at you funny all day, and some people will, you know, recognize you, and it's like, or they'll have them on themselves, and other people will keep their distance from you. It's a very interesting experience to walk around with a cross of ash on your forehead.
The drive-thru received about 20 commuters in a little over an hour. Pastor Aaron Roberts says he plans to make the Ash Wednesday drive-thru an annual tradition at Colonial Church. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
After the break, hear a collaboration between a local rapper and a jazz band. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, the parents of a handcuffed teen were charged with child abuse. Missouri's Budget Committee said no to Governor Jay Nixon's Medicaid expansion proposal. And Governor Sam Brownback's plans to offset income tax cuts hit bumpy roads. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
A Kansas Senate committee endorsed Governor Brownback's income tax cuts but didn't go along with ending the tax deduction for property taxes, and 200 real estate agents, including Dwight Goodwin of Overland Park, demonstrated against the part eliminating the mortgage interest deduction.
At this time in the market recovery that we're experiencing in the housing industry, I don't feel like it's time to cut this tax deduction, which would discourage the recovery of the market.
In protest of a court ruling that Kansas has to increase its school funding, a constitutional amendment denying courts the power to dictate dollar amounts of appropriations was gaining legislator momentum. Kansas City, Kansas School Superintendent Cynthia Lane said the lawmakers were about to upset the system of checks and balances.
It takes away the right of citizens to say, wait a minute, we disagree, and to ask for the courts to help us figure that out.
A bill that would prohibit Kansas local governments or public entities from lobbying their legislators drew outcries from counties, cities, and school districts. The NRA's Patricia Stoneking spoke in favor of the bill.
I've always questioned the validity of encountering opposition at those hearings from lobbyists being paid with taxpayer funds, public funds, to lobby against a legal product.
Also under committee discussion was a bill to limit where Kansas adult-themed businesses can be located and prohibiting lap dances. The Missouri House passed a pair of voter photo ID bills, one a constitutional amendment. Since the state Supreme Court declared the last photo ID bill unconstitutional, Democrat Chris Kelly of Columbia admonished his colleagues,
Jim Crow is alive in this room today.
The Senate sent the House a work comp bill that prohibits lawsuits over occupational diseases and would solve the insolvency problem of the Second Injury Fund by doubling the fees businesses pay into it and restricting the kind of injuries covered. A committee considered a plan to make it harder to win discriminatory firing lawsuits. Missouri Chamber of Commerce attorney Rich Aubuchon told the panel,
companies are choosing to locate in other states, and I'm not going to tell you that this is the only reason, but certainly it is a factor.
And a committee heard testimony, including from Kansas City Mayor Sly James, on another reason companies locate elsewhere, border wars, economic incentives. The House Budget Committee rejected the idea of taking $908 million federal dollars to expand Medicaid. Chair Rick Stream said that would also cost the state another $46 million in federal funds.
We've spread it out over different areas. I can't make any promises of where it'll eventually end up. There's some money in the preschool program.
And as the deadline passed for states to confirm that they'll set up health insurance exchanges under the federal health care law, Missouri legislators were wanting no part of that. Wrapping up the week, the owner of Edge Auto Sales on Highway 40 was accused of the biggest identity theft operation ever prosecuted in Missouri, taking customers' identities to take out $1 million in phony car loans. David and Pamela Martin, father and stepmother of a teenage boy found handcuffed in a Northland basement, were charged with child abuse, and Royals broadcaster Bob Davis retired from that post but will continue to do KU football and basketball. This is KCUR.
Up until the 1950s in Kansas City, if you were sick, the color of your skin determined where you could go for care. The film, From Separate to Equal, the creation of Truman Medical Center, explores the history of segregated medicine in Kansas City and how black health leaders helped break down those barriers. The film is showing this Saturday at the Black Archives of Mid-America, so we thought we'd listen back to a 2011 interview that KCUR's Alana Gordon conducted with director Kevin Wilmot and producer Greg Hurd.
Kevin, you've directed a film, Confederate States of America, also The Only Good Indian. How did you get drawn to this topic about black health care in Kansas City?
Greg and I took a tour of Truman a few years ago, and they have this wall of a history of really kind of Kansas City health care in terms of segregation and in terms of how Truman was kind of created. And it really struck us. And I talked to John Bluford last summer and told him, you know, let's make this film. And
the head of Truman Medical Center.
Yeah, that's right. And he said, great, let's do it. And so we kind of made it happen.
Greg and Kevin, was it hard to find people to talk about this? Because it seems like on the one hand, there's been so many great successes and developments. And on the other hand, there is this kind of dark side to the history of healthcare and integration of healthcare, access to healthcare.
At first, we thought it would be hard to find people to talk about it, and we soon found that people really wanted to talk about it. A lot of the people we interviewed were in their 80s, some in their 90s, people who had experienced a total kind of segregation, and in medical care, it was pretty complete. There was not access to good health care for many, many years until the 20th century was well underway. So the people we spoke with brought repositories of stories with them and really relished sharing with us.
So there were black hospitals and there were white hospitals in Kansas City. What were the main hospitals? Where did African Americans get their health care?
Well, I think the main hospital that African Americans received their health care from was called General Hospital No. 2. And, you know, when I tell people that story, you know, that there was General Hospital and then there was General Hospital No. 2, which was the black hospital, you can't help but just laugh because it's so absurd. I mean, you cannot believe that you know, if I made that up in a story, I think that people wouldn't believe that existed, that you'd had one hospital that was like the number one and then you had one that was number two. And so, you know, that was the main city hospital for black people.
Where was that?
That's where Children's Mercy Hospital is now. So it's a real part of the history of Kansas City that I think defined the black experience in Kansas City for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And then the other big private hospital was Wheatley Provident Hospital that Dr. Edward Perry created. And in the film there, we have several people who are really heroes in the black community that through the force of will of their passion to try to correct the problem, you know, created these health care facilities out of nothing, really.
What was General Hospital 2 like?
It was older. It had been around for, as a building, as a place for medical care, had been around for about 30, 35 years when it was transferred into becoming General Hospital No. 2. So the facility was a bit worn. The actual medical equipment was not first rate, and a lot of it was used. A lot of it was from the past. The General Hospital No. 1 was the one getting most of the good things.
You know, we have a story in the film about General No. 2, and this is a good example of how the differences between equipment.
I remember vividly that we didn't have an incubator for the newborn, and we had to use a basket and a light bulb and put the towel over the light bulb.
It's kind of like, you know, what you see in a classroom for hatching chickens or something, you know? And the fact that they had to do that, you know, and made it work somehow and saved lives that way, pretty amazing.
It was a much more difficult, labor-intensive circumstance. But that brought about a really close-knit community of healthcare providers who were very, very dedicated to what they were doing. And people were receiving good care.
I think that's the thing that you're struck with when you hear the stories of people that lived through that experience was how dedicated the physicians and the nurses and the staff. I mean, it was a really strong community. And one of the good things about segregation is that it forces you to really have community. And, you know, when you can't, you know, enter this other door, you have to make the best of what you have available to you. And it just created this, I think, institution that really was the place that black doctors went, one of the major places black doctors went in the country to become trained.
And so going from there to what the situation we have today, we have Truman Medical Center now, we have hospitals that are integrated. And you mentioned that it wasn't an easy process to get there.
No. And in that sense, Truman is a real forerunner, you know, because I think the other segregated hospitals in the country, they didn't integrate until much later. You know, they didn't integrate until like the 60s. And so Truman is, you know, is the combination of General Hospital No. 1, the white hospital, and General No. 2, the black hospital. They formed eventually and turned into Truman Medical Center. And it took about 10 years, but they were able to make it work. And there were some really progressive people in the city that really, I think, made that happen.
Yeah, Albert Morrow, E. Gray Diamond, Charles Wheeler were instrumental in bringing about this change.
And as well, you know, they were black doctors that they worked with, that they sought out and consulted with, that I think made a big difference in the success of it. So it wasn't a top-down kind of mm-hmm. approach they took. It was a real equal justice, equal rights kind of approach that they took. And I think that's the thing that really made it work. And so Truman, in that sense, is kind of a real success story, you know, in terms of, you know, how a horrible situation. And, you know, most of the black physicians, when you talk to them today, you know, they talk about, you know, there was a tunnel between number one and number two, a tunnel that connected the two hospitals. And the black physicians talked about it like it was a place where number one was able to siphon things from number two. And so, you know,
from number two,
from number two, they would take things from number two, and that it was a way to kind of keep the segregation hidden as well. So that the classes that blacks took in number one, you went through the tunnel to go over there to the class over in number one. So you didn't walk through the front door. You didn't walk. There wasn't a visible kind of presence there. And all of that was really interesting in the sense that, you know, when Truman is finally created, it just breaks all of that open. Mm-hmm. And it's the thing that when changes like that happen, it just advances the entire city. Mm-hmm. And I think it was one of those signposts that really led to a more progressive community in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kevin Wilmot, Greg Hurd, director, producer of the new documentary From Separate to Equal, the creation of Truman Medical Center. Thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Wilmot and Hurd spoke with KCUR's Alana Gordon back in 2011. Their film will be showing on Saturday afternoon at the Black Archives of Mid-America and followed by a panel discussion. We end today's show with a new recording of a song by the local rapper Reach. It's called How to Fish and was written for his grandfather. This recording is a collaboration with the jazz group Diverse and singer Julia Hale.
Yo. Took a solid moment in remembrance of him. An angler of the soul, a true fisherman of men. I wrote a couple words and I'ma send them on the winds. I'm sure that you and God are talking, skimming when you can. I realize you're gone, but I know you left your recipe. We're living in your words and we're basking in your legacy. Rest in peace for now, we'll see you later on. If nothing else, we'll see you every time we play the song. I say to y'all, he caught us all like a card. Life was hard, but he got it right with God. And now he's on the other side. See him in my mother's eyes. In a few, we'll be together again when the sun arrives. Yes, you passed, you went away. And that's too bad. I value what you taught. You're the dad I never had. Some of your words, honestly, I left them in the past. Didn't all stick, but surely the message has.
My granddad never bought a lot of gifts, but he handed me a rod and he taught me how to fish. My granddad never bought a lot of gifts, but he handed me a rod and he taught me how to fish. My granddad never bought a lot of gifts, but he handed me a rod and he taught me how to fish. My granddad never bought a lot of gifts.
I'm a fisherman now, you're living through your grandson. I ain't sitting around, cause that'll leave me hamstrung. It's like I got a son that I gotta raise. So I gotta grind, I ain't got it made. That means I gotta work and gotta keep a job in. That means I gotta grow and gotta leap the frog in. That means I gotta pray, find a piece of God in. Fishing with discipline, I gotta keep the rod, man. You taught me well, grandpa, I'm on the wagon now. And I won't let this old world come and drag me down. It gets hard, but I ain't really one for backing out. So I'ma live for now and come and join you after a while. Yes, you passed, you went away, and that's too bad. I value what you taught, you're the dad I never had. Some of your words, honestly, I left them in the past. Didn't all stick, but surely the message has.
My granddad never bought a lot of gifts.
but he handed me a rod and he taught me how to fish. My granddad never bought a lot of gifts, but he handed me a rod and he taught me how to fish. My granddad never bought a lot of gifts, but he handed me a rod and he taught me how to fish. My granddad never bought a lot of gifts. La 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 la.
Was Reach rapping with the jazz band Diverse and singer Julia Hale. They'll be opening for Talib Kweli at the Granada in Lawrence this Friday. And on February 27th, they'll all be part of a tribute to record producer Jay Dilla at the Blue Room at the American Jazz Museum.
Thanks for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Zach Lewandowski and Monica Sandretsky. Theme music is by Approach. And of course, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.